I am an apprentice, like many, many of us, to be at the feet of the mother. And you will pardon me sometimes if I am autobiographical. Like many young people of India who have been brought up under the philosophy of individualism, competition, of autonomy, it is very difficult for me to be submissive. And the psychology of looking upon the world with a sense of, if not superiority, with a sense of equality, was very predominant in my consciousness for many, many years in my boyhood and college days. The background in which I lived was disrespectful to the ideas of gods and goddesses, disrespectful to all authority, and the idea of surrender was anathema. But it is under a great state of mental crisis through which I passed between the age of 16 and 19, during which I sought only one important answer: what is truth? I had heard of Swami Vivekananda, who was asking question as to whether those who claimed to be God lovers, if they had seen God. In my intellectual arrogance, I had a feeling I will not ask this question, whether one has seen God or not. My question was whether one can prove intellectually whether God exists or not. If you believe in God because you see, that is much more simple. Without seeing God and yet intellectually prove that He exists, that I felt was much more important, perhaps much more difficult, and it was that question which I was asking all the time. And there are many other intellectual questions which had arisen in my mind. By the age of 11, I had read the Anand Saraswati's Satyas Prakash. That was one of my important landmarks in my intellectual development. By 14, I had read much of Swami Vivekananda and Ramakrishna. And by 16, I had read almost everything that Gandhi had written. This was my intellectual search. And then I studied a great deal of logic and world history and economics between the age of 16 and 19. And also particularly I made a study of Greek philosophy and modern philosophy, Descartes and Spinoza and Leibniz and Kant and Hegel and Bradley and Bertrand Russell and so on. And also made a study of Nyaya and Vaisheshika and Sankhya and Yoga and Purva Mimamsa, Uttara Mimamsa, and various schools of Indian philosophy. Studied quite a lot of the Bhagavad Gita. And I felt that none of them had answered the basic questions. And I was asking why people talk of so many great minds who have not been able to answer some of the basic questions on the answers of which our life can be truly built. If I want to serve the world and myself or anybody, I must know what is this world for, why has it come into being, and how best can you serve this world. Of course, I had seen the study of Vedanta, the theory of the absolute Brahman, and the concept of Maya was all the time full of Maya for me, because it was supposed to be the most intellectually satisfying answer, which itself admitted it is inexplicable. And yet it was regarded to be the most wonderful answer in the whole Indian philosophy. And I was wondering how that philosophy can be regarded as the acme of philosophical thought. I was perhaps very rebellious to many of my friends, whether they belonged to Western tradition or Indian tradition, but I was quite desperate and rebellious. But at the same time, I was very, very pained by the fact that I had no answer. It was at that time that I think Mother contrived that I should read The Life Divine. This is how I see now, retrospectively. A friend of mine who was studying with me in my college in Bombay, his uncle had read The Life Divine without understanding it. And he told his nephew, who was my partner in the hostel, that he should read that book and tell him the summary of that book. So that friend of mine that evening came to me and said, "Kirit, you must read this book." He said, "You know that I am engaged in a romance at present. I have no mood to read books. And you read this book and tell me what this book contains." So when I read the title, The Life Divine, I said, "Must be once again Maya." So I left it on my table. I said, "All these philosophers talk of Maya, explain nothing at all, and give no meaning to life." So that is how the book remained for 1 week on my table, and I did not touch it. But my uncle was more persistent, and he asked him, "Have you read that book?" And he came on that day and said, "Please, don't read for God's sake, read for my sake. But read this book." So I remember on that particular day, I happened to read The Life Divine. I started it and went on the whole night, and with a little rest at night, next day and next day and the next day. The first part of the volume I read in 4 days' time, and I came to the conclusion. I did not know. I knew that Sri Aurobindo was the author, but I did not know who Sri Aurobindo is. And I told my friend, "If there is only one person in the history of the world who knows the truth and who speaks the truth truthfully, it's only one person, that is Sri Aurobindo." This was my intellectual conviction. He had proved to me intellectually that God exists, intellectually. Later on, when I read Mother saying that Life Divine is intellectually perfect, it was simply a confirmation in my own consciousness of the conclusion that I had arrived at when I was 19 years old. There is no book in the world history which is intellectually as perfect as The Life Divine. I consider this to be the first boon that Mother gave to me, to give me the chance to read The Life Divine, and gave me a great balm to my intellectual query. Thereafter, I have had no skepticism of any kind. I was totally liberated from skepticism. I came to the conclusion definitively God exists, that this world is a gradual manifestation of the divine consciousness. Because it is gradual, it is not perfect. It is possible to make this world perfect if divine manifestation can take place fully, and that it is possible to make it fully manifest. These were three conclusions intellectually. From the age of 19, I have never doubted. All my life is a confirmation of these three statements. But still, there is no question of submission, and I can only say intellectually, because of my great satisfaction, if I could say truthfully that if I bowed to anybody in my life, it was to Sri Aurobindo. The only person to whom I can bow down effortlessly. There was no question at all in my mind that he is the only person in the world to whom you can give yourself. After 2-3 years, I was still studying, and I read still more of Sri Aurobindo in the meantime. Until one day, one of my teachers, he asked me, "Do you want to go to Darshan, to Pondicherry?" So I said, "I would like to go one day, but from whatever I have read, I have found that to do the yoga of Sri Aurobindo, you must attain first Brahmic consciousness. Because where all the roads end, Sri Aurobindo's yoga begins." So I said, "I must first attain to Brahmic consciousness, then I can be fit to go to the ashram to visit the ashram." So I said, "I have not yet reached Brahmic consciousness, so how can I think of going to the ashram?" So he smiled. So he said, "But tell me, would you like to go?" So I said, "If I'm not qualified, and yet if I can go, I'll be happy." So he wrote a letter to the mother and got permission for me to go. At that time, you must know that it was very difficult to get admission even to visit the ashram. Not many of you may be knowing with this fact, but it's a fact that even to visit the ashram, you have to have a very special permission. And within a week's time, he told me, he said, "Mother has permitted, so you can come with me. I'm going on the 1st of November. So 7 days I remain in Golconda. And I had no questions in my mind, because intellectually I was perfectly at home. And the only boon I had was to see the mother several times a day, because at that time mother used to be coming to the balcony at about 9:45, 10 o'clock. Not many people used to, ashramites were not there at that time. All visitors used to sit below the balcony, and when mother would suddenly come, would rush out and see the mother from the balcony. And then, of course, she used to go for playing tennis, and one could see a mother playing tennis. And this was a very elevating experience for me, to see the mother playing tennis. And I used to feel, when she used to hit a ball, I used to feel as if the whole universe was being smashed by one hit of mother's racket. And that is the majesty of the mother. And then in the evening, she used to distribute groundnuts to people all who used to come there. And visitors also had the privilege at that time. And that was another time when one could go and meet them, see the mother. But on 7th November, when I was leaving, and when I went to the mother for her blessings, she gave me a bunch of jasmine flowers, what they call flowers of purity. And she gave me a smile which has remained immortal for me. Even today, when I remember that smile of the mother, then I said, I am now at the feet of the mother. That was the time when I fell at the feet of the mother. I often ask this question, what is it to be at the feet of the mother? There is in our tradition a great place given to the guru, to the teacher. We even speak of Guru Brahma, Guru Vishnu, and so on. But I must confess that I have not looked upon the mother as a guru. And even the way in which in Indian tradition the worship of gurus extolled, I don't harmonize so easily. And I was greatly gratified when Mother, when Sri Aurobindo wrote that the guru of the integral yoga does not arrogate to himself guruhood. It's a tremendous statement that the guru of the integral yoga does not arrogate to himself guruhood. That he is a brother calling the brethren. He is a child leading the children. If that is the meaning of the guru, I prostrate. See, there's no question of submission or pranam or it is a prostration. This is the guru at whose feet I can be always lying blissfully forever. And that is the mother. That is the guru who is a friend and who walks with you. And who takes care of you so thoroughly and does not allow you to relax. This is one aspect of the mother, my own personal relation with the mother is, I have not found her allowing me relaxing. As mother herself said, this yoga is not for those people who, having finished the work, they want to sit at the back. And this is the spirit I love very much. Mother has spoken of vigilance and a constant vigilance awakening. And as you all know, Sri Aurobindo has spoken of personal effort in our yoga. So much importance is laid on the personal effort. You know, there are two statements which I hear from many of my friends in the ashram, in Auroville, many places. We are all doing mother's work. This is one statement I hear very often. The second is, mother will do everything. And I tell you, both the statements I fully disagree with. There was one disciple who wrote a letter to the mother. I had taken it to the mother and said, mother, I am traveling all over India to do mother's work. So mother told me, you cannot do mother's work, mother said to me. Tell him, you cannot do mother's work. You first of all aspire to offer. Secondly, you begin to offer your work to the mother. Your work to the mother. Don't say, I'm doing mother's work. It is at a very high level. When you reach a kind of union with the divine's will, when the divine will manifest through your consciousness, when you receive the rays of Mother's work straight coming from her, transmitted to you, and when you are simply moved, then you can say, perhaps, if you at all want to say, that you are doing that to you, you should still remain you, that you are doing Mother's work. Similarly, the statement, Mother will do everything. It's also a great statement. I don't want to discourage anybody when people say Mother will do everything. But Sri Aurobindo himself has written very clearly, and that is very connected with this, to be at the feet of the Mother. If you think that the Divine will do everything, you remain what you are. Do not be deceived. It's a big illusion. Inert passivity is the one thing which has to be exiled if you really want to be at the feet of the Mother. Sri Aurobindo, while speaking of threefold labor of personal effort, the aspiration, rejection, and surrender. Even the word surrender is used, Sri Aurobindo, for personal effort. It requires personal effort to surrender. It is only when personal effort comes to a very high level, high intensity, that a real submission begins to take place. And Sri Aurobindo has put down three great conditions to arrive at that condition. It is a condition of glad and strong submission. Glad and strong submission. And obedience of the illumined disciple of truth. Illumined disciple of the truth. Secondly, inner warrior who fights against obscurity and falsehood. And thirdly, faithful servant of the divine. When these three things combine together, then we can say we are now approaching what is called this submission and surrender to the divine. It is when that surrender becomes perfect that you can truthfully say Mother will do everything. This is how I see. I may be wrong in my understanding, but this is how I see. To be at the feet of the Mother, according to me, is a long process of asadhana, which requires a tremendous effort at getting illumination of the mind. And that illumination speaks all the time of truth and truth and truth and truth and nothing but the truth. And to be a courageous hero and a warrior who fights against obscurity and falsehood, which is a tremendously difficult task. And to be a servant and a faithful servant, and that too of the divine. These three conditions put together, when they can be combined, then I can say now, one is fit to be at the feet of the Divine Mother. That's why I introduce myself as an apprentice. And I cannot say I have moved very far in this apprenticeship. It's a very long apprenticeship. But that is itself a joyous process of development. But let me come to the last part of what I want to say today. I spoke of the sense of submission, sense of surrender, obedience to the teacher, to the guru. But what is most unique, as far as the feet of the mother are concerned, it is that the Divine Mother is the incarnation of the Divine Mother. That Sri Aurobindo is the avatar. Once again, to the present climate of intellectual arrogance, the concept of worship is an anathema. The concept of surrender is anathema. And now if you say or speak of surrender to the avatar, and to conceive and to regard the mother and Sri Aurobindo as avatar, and try to understand what this means. This has been my subject for the last 50 years. What is avatar? Even in the Indian tradition, there are many who do not believe in avatar. Arya Samaj, for example, rejects the theory of avatarhood. There are many other trends in Indian thought which do not accept avatarhood. The Veda does not speak of avatarhood. Upanishad does not speak of avatarhood. The Gita speaks eloquently of the avatarhood. The Puranas speak of avatarhood. Shaivism speaks of it. Vaishnavism speaks of it. And even there, the concepts of avatar have remained so woolly and so inadequate, one does not know what is this avatarhood. And in that inadequacy, if you look upon the mother as avatar, Sri Aurobindo is the avatar, and to be at the feet of the mother as the avatar, it is even more complex, more difficult. This has been a subject of my study for many, many years. What is an avatar? One day, a student had written to the mother a letter. "Mother, we have heard that Sri Aurobindo was Leonardo da Vinci in one of his births. Is it true?" So Sri Aurobindo, mother answered that letter. It was a great lesson for me, and I want to share with you what mother wrote in answer to that letter. Mother said, "It cannot be said that Sri Aurobindo was Leonardo da Vinci. But it is true that the soul that was Leonardo da Vinci was borrowed by the Supreme Lord when he came down as an avatar as Sri Aurobindo." It's a very, very illuminating statement. The soul that was Leonardo da Vinci, that soul was borrowed by the Supreme Lord when he came down as an avatar as Sri Aurobindo. In fact, in the Gita it is said, "He who understands avatarhood understands everything." So, and this is very true. This complex statement, if we can understand the mystery of it, then the secret of avatarhood is understood. In fact, as many of you might have seen, Sri Aurobindo wrote 3 important chapters in Essays on the Gita on the avatarhood. And these 3 chapters put a seal, actually, on the truth of avatarhood, the role of the avatarhood, and the process of the avatarhood. How does the avatar come on the earth? As Sri Aurobindo says, avatar does not come on the earth to display miracles. He can do miracles even without coming on the earth as an avatar. The avatarhood is in this world a part of the machinery of the movement of the world itself. To speak briefly about it, can be said that the ultimate goal of this world movement is to have the full manifestation of the divine on the earth. And if you ask the question, what is the meaning of the full manifestation of the divine, is the divine himself must be descended fully, permanently, forever and ever. In other words, you might say, the ultimate aim is a permanent avatar manifestation, constant manifestation of avatarhood of the divine on the earth. It is because the present world manifestation is incomplete, gradual, that whenever there is a possibility of that, to the extent to which the divine manifestation becomes possible, that particular manifestation we call avatar. It happens, as Sri Aurobindo has used the word, is a kind of a reflex action from the divine. Create a condition on the earth such that there is a reflex, immediate striking from this above, from the Supreme, and he is manifest here. At one time, Mother had said to our teachers in the school, "You think all of you today with words. I ask you to think with ideas. In future, I will ask you to think with experiences." She had given 3 steps of her development, a program. Today you think with words. I ask you now to think with ideas. A time will come when I'll ask you to think with experiences. Now, when I was studying this problem of avatarhood, I was in this group at that time, what Mother had said, think with ideas. And I was giving a lecture in my class, and suddenly when I was speaking of the avatarhood, without understanding it, as most of the preachers do not know when they speak what they're speaking about. And suddenly, I felt this reflex, this word, Sri Aurobindo used the word, avatarhood is a reflex from above in a certain situation of the world. What is this reflex? Is instantaneous. This instantaneousness is the key to the whole concept of avatarhood. This whole world is actually speaking a field in which the divine drama is being rehearsed. And when this world drama becomes ready for real action of the avatar, real manifestation, it doesn't take time, it just enters into the world and accomplishes the task. But once again, when the world begins to languish, those conditions are over, then there is a kind of a withdrawal. Once again, there's a preparation for the avatarhood. I would not dwell upon this subject further. I would only say that when we read Savitri, it can be read in many ways, from many points of view. But Savitri is Sri Aurobindo's worship of the mother. One does not see Sri Aurobindo as a worshipper. But whenever mother, Sri Aurobindo writes about the mother, every word that Sri Aurobindo writes about her is a worship of the mother. And Sri Aurobindo is supreme in Savitri whenever Sri Aurobindo describes the mother. Even the word Awakening Ray, which is the title of your magazine, Awakening Ray, is one of the expressive terms that Sri Aurobindo used for the Divine Mother. The Awakening Ray. When the first manifestation, the first avatar, the very ancient, most ancient times, when the first avatar came, and when the first, this was just before the first myth that is Savitri was written. It's a very interesting thing Sri Aurobindo says. Savitri is an eternal myth which was written at the very first instance. It repeats itself. It's a story of the avatarhood. The secret of the avatarhood. And that secret story of Savitri is what Sri Aurobindo tells in his great book. And although in the first canto, Sri Aurobindo describes Savitri, that again you must see the worship of the Divine Mother. When Sri Aurobindo describes Savitri in the very first canto, and then when you come to Ashwapati's book 3, the book 3 of the mother, and the mother's boon to Ashwapati when he prays, and when the Supreme Divine Mother gives a boon and says, she will come, and then the description of Savitri that you is again worship of the Divine Mother. And as Mother said, Savitri is a prophetic vision of the future. In Savitri itself, in the 11th book, Supreme Consummation, the soul's choice and the supreme consummation, there again, when Savitri is offered the supreme happiness and bliss, complete withdrawal from this world, and Savitri refuses to take that boon and speaks of the problem of the world and the earth and the necessity to be on the earth. And then the Divine Supreme becomes so happy with that beautiful slave of God. Then she says, that the Supreme Lord says, the Mighty Mother will come one day. And that description that is given is the prophetic vision which was vision at that time prophetic, but it was that mother whom we saw playing tennis, being with us as our teacher. It is that avatar at whose feet I think we all should be lying all the time. Thank you. Shall we meditate for 5 minutes? Yes.